Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the first talk of Eugenics Fest 2009. I am Raghib Hassan from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and this is a joint work with Professor Radu Sayan of Stony Brook and Professor Marianne Winslet of Illinois. Today, I'm going to talk about how we can secure provenance information associated with digital objects. But before we go on to all that, let's start with a game. The name of the game is Let's Spot the Fake. I show you here two paintings. One of them is painted by Picasso, and the other one is a fake. I'm not really an art connoisseur, so when I look at these pictures, all I see is two persons with horribly contorted faces. But maybe someone among you will be able to see the inner beauty of these paintings. So, how many of you think that the one on the left is the fake one? One, two, three, okay, maybe four, five, six, okay. And how many things on the one on the right is the fake? A lot of you. Well, I have a really enlightened audience here because you're right. The one on the left is a painting of Dora Maar, Picasso's friend Dora Maar, and her cat. You can see the cat on her right shoulder. There's a small cat. It's one of the costliest paintings of the world. It was auctioned off in 2004 for $101 million. The one on the right, on the other hand, was painted by a forger. It was listed on eBay before it was taken out, and it's totally worthless. Well, not maybe worthless, it's worth something, a few bucks for the frame and everything. Now, if you have hundreds of millions of dollars to burn and to buy a painting, how do you know that you are not getting ripped off? Well, there are many factors that people use, but one of the biggest things people use is provenance records of paintings. Now, what is a provenance record? A provenance record is actually a total history of the painting, that is, who painted it, who owned it, and how it was bought and sold through different owners all the way up to the current owner. This is a really important concept in arts, archaeology, and archives, and it's often been termed as the fundamental principle of archival. I show you an example here. This genuine Picasso, which hangs in the Museum of Modern Art. And if you go to their webpage, you can bring up its provenance record, which shows who owned the painting and when Picasso sold the painting to the first owner, then how different owners bought and sold this, and how it came to the Museum of Modern Art. Now, that was the world of arts. Let's come to the real world of digital data. Our life today is totally dependent on digital data. We use data all the time. And in most cases, these data come from other people, from other sources. And throughout its lifetime, the data we use have gone through different people. Now, the problem is some of these people we can trust, and some of these people we can't. We don't know them. We don't know what they did with the data. So data is also stored in different databases and media. And again, some of the data storage we can trust and some others we can't. And sometimes even the users, you don't have to have an intruder in your system to tamper data. Sometimes even the insiders have incentives to modify data. Remember Enron? So in the past, when you got data, when you used to store data in physical files, it would take someone hours and hours to modify, physically go through paper files and modify all of them. But now everything is stored digitally. We store all the data in databases and other storage media, and all it takes is for someone to just issue a command and then tamper millions and millions of records really fast. So in this untrustworthy world, when we get data from someone else, how do you know that we are getting back untampered data? How can we trust the data? Well, one way of getting to trust the data is to know its history, know how it was created, how it was modified, and transmitted to the current owner. In other words, we have to look at the provenance of data to know whether we can trust it. So what exactly is data provenance? The term is highly overloaded. You read different papers, and in every paper, people have defined it in a different way. But anyway, the common thing is data provenance records the history, the ownership history, the lineage, and the different transformations and derivations that happened to bring the data to its current state, to a later state. This has been widely used in by scientists to record the processes that could that generate their scientific data sets, and so on. So this is a chart from Yogesh Sinha's 2005 paper that shows the different provenance systems. Don't blame me to force you to read this horrible chart. I only want you to focus on the top row, which shows the different application domains of these existing provenance systems. If you look there, you'll see physics, astronomy, biology, and a lot of other scientific applications. So as you can guess, the common theme of all the systems you saw in the previous page is that they're all scientific computing systems. And scientists generally trust people. They don't consider security issues. They don't consider that people might come in and tamper data and lie and cheat. But if we want to bring provenance to the mainstream, if we want to use provenance for, say, financial records, banking records, accounting records, then we have to provide integrity, confidentiality, and privacy guarantees. In other words, we have to make sure that the provenance of data itself can be verified for integrity, and also we protect privacy, confidentiality. In other words, again, we have to have provenance of provenance, or a model for secure provenance. Now, in this paper, we introduce what we mean by secure provenance. By secure provenance, we mean we want to prevent people from undetectably rewrite history. Well, I should explain here a little bit. We cannot really prevent someone from deleting or modifying provenance. If the data is on their own storage, they have complete access, they can always modify things. But what we want to do is to prevent someone from undetectably rewriting things. That is, if someone changes something, if someone tampers something, we should be able to detect that. At the same time, we also worry about confidentiality and privacy. So if someone wants to keep some of their work accessible only to certain people they trust, we should be able to do that. So here's our usage and threat model. In our model for secure provenance, we consider that there are users who edit documents on their machines. They have complete access to the history of the document and also the document itself. And they edit documents. Now, these documents doesn't necessarily have to be files. They can be any container of data, maybe database tuples and anything. So whatever change a user makes in a document gets recorded in an entry called the provenance entry. And a chronologically sorted list of these provenance entries form the provenance chain of the document. As the document physically gets passed around different users, they make different modifications, and these entries tend to accumulate at the end of the provenance chain. And the provenance information also accompanies the document as it moves around. Now, when someone wants to verify the integrity of the provenance chain, they go to auditors. The auditors are semi-trusted principals who can verify the integrity of a provenance chain. And at the same time, if they're trusted by a user, then they can read the contents of whatever modification the user made. So if Alice trusts Audrey, then Audrey can see what Alice did with the document. Next, we have bad guys. So these bad guys may be external, or they can also be internal users. For example, Alice may regret her own actions, then turn into bad guy Marvin. What do they want to do? They want to add or remove stuff from the history, and they might want to collude with other users or other adversaries to insert fake things, and then they might want to switch provenance chain. They might want to take a perfectly valid and verifiable provenance chain of one document and then attach it to a different document. They might also want to repudiate their own actions, whatever action they took on the document. More details of this threat model can be found in our storage assess paper. Now, there have been a lot of work on providing integrity assurances for storage systems. For example, we have the source code repositories such as CVS and secure versions of it that provide some sort of integrity guarantees between different versions. However, most of these systems are centralized with and assuming that their repository is trusted, stored in a trusted, and even if some of them have been developed in a distributed manner, they still have a logically centralized repository. So we cannot just take that and apply to mobile documents. Then there are file systems, such as Sunder, Passage, DCFS, which provide integrity assurances for locally stored files. So if you take your file and store in such a file system, then later you can get a guarantee of its integrity. However, as I said earlier, we consider documents that move from system to system between users. So if everyone used such a trusted file systems, then we could have provided some guarantee. But here, that's not the case in the real world. And then in Mary Baker's 2002 paper, there was a work on system state entanglement. So by entangling your state with everyone else in the system, ensure that no one can lie, because everyone takes the state of other people and entangles with their own states. So at the end of the day, everyone no one can lie because others will serve as witnesses to their previous actions. So if all our files were stored in a centralized location, then we could have entangled the state of one file with another and then provide integrity assurances in this way. But here again, our files are not they do not stay in the same place all the time. They move between users and users. And finally, we had a ton of work on secure audit logs that provide integrity for audit logs and audit trails. Most of these systems depend on the existence of a trusted notary who certifies logs, or maybe a trusted third party, which has to be given the hash chain seed. So clearly, we cannot take any of these approaches and apply to our scenario. So here is what we do to protect our provenance chain. I apologize for the horrible color you see there. My laptop has some problems, so the colors are not coming out right. I don't have a bad color choice. So in our scheme, we form the provenance chain as a sequence of chronological order sequence of provenance records. And this may be stored in a file or may be stored in a database. And each provenance entry, or each provenance record, consists of these components. First, we have the user identity entry that stores the information about the identity of the principal, the identity of the user who is making this change. This can, depending on applications, this can include the user ID, the process ID, host, IP, and lots of other timestamps and other information. The next component, the W component, is the encrypted modification log. So this contains a log of what the user did in that session. And this is, of course, encrypted to protect privacy and confidentiality. And we include the keys we need to decrypt the modification log in the next entry, the K entry. I'll elaborate more on this in the next few slides. And finally, we have the checksum and the integrity checksum to protect the integrity of the provenance chain, to protect history. So let's recap what we mean by protecting confidentiality. Here, we want to protect the document modification log from untrustworthy people. So each user trusts a subset of the auditors, and only the trusted auditors should be able to see what the user did in that particular session. Now, if there's a single auditor, then the solution is trivial. We just take the auditor's key and then encrypt the modification log with the auditor's key, and then we are fine. We then have an encrypted modification log, and we include that in the provenance entry right away. Okay, we are fine. But now we have multiple auditors that the user trusts. So what we can do here is take the modification log, encrypt it multiple times with each of the trusted auditor's keys. So we end up with a bunch of encrypted modification log. Each is encrypted with a different trusted auditor's key. This is fine, but this is also very inefficient. We end up with a If Alice trusts 10 auditors, then we end up with 10 copies of the encrypted modification log, which wastes a lot of space. We can improve this a lot by this simple scheme. We encrypt the modification log with a secret key, with a temporary secret key, and then we take that key and encrypt it multiple times with each of the trusted auditors' keys. So at the end of the day, we end up with an encrypted modification log per entry, per provenance entry, and also a bunch of keys that the trusted auditors can use to unlock or decrypt this modification log. We can further optimize this by using broadcast encryption tree to minimize the number of keys we'll have to include in the provenance entry. So our confidentiality scheme is as follows. In the W entry, the encrypted modification log entry, we include the encrypted modification log encrypted with secret key, KI. We also throw in the hash of the current document to provide a binding between the current provenance record and that particular version of the document. And in the K entry, we include the set of keys, one key per auditor, one key per trusted auditor. Next, we show how we provide integrity. So remember that we want to protect two things. We want to protect the integrity of each entry, and also we want to protect the chronological order of entries in the provenance chain. To do that, we use a signature chain scheme here to create the provenance, to create the checksum entry for a new provenance entry. We take the last checksum from the last provenance entry in the chain. Then we also take the new provenance entry, hash it, concatenate it with the last provenance entry, and then sign it. And this becomes the new checksum or new provenance, a new signature for the latest provenance entry. By using this signature chain, we can ensure that no one can new stuff, because if someone modifies something in the middle of the chain, then the signatures or the checksums of the subsequent entries will not match. We can do much more than that. We can do much more beyond just encrypting whole modification log. Sometimes we need really fine-grained control over confidentiality, particularly when we're releasing things to the outside world. For example, suppose that we have this classified document, which has some secret stuff marked in red, and also it has its provenance chain, and in some of the provenance entries, there are bits and pieces of information that can be considered as classified. Now, if we want to declassify this document because of a freedom of information request, what we can do is to redact the secret stuff and then publish the redacted document. But now, if we want to include the provenance information also with the redacted document, what can we do? If we release the provenance chain as it is, then it will leak the secret information, because some of the provenance entries might contain bits and pieces of secret stuff. But if we want to remove the secret stuff, if we want to redact the secret attributes from the provenance chain itself, then if we just delete that, it will break the integrity protection scheme, because the signatures and the checksums will no longer match. So what can we do? To solve this problem, we can use cryptographic commitments as follows. Suppose that in our provenance entry, somewhere in some component, we have some sensitive information and also some non-sensitive information. To create the provenance entry for this provenance attribute, we go like this. So we keep the non-sensitive and sensitive information as it is in the provenance entry, but we also include the cryptographic commitment of the sensitive information. Now, a cryptographic commitment is, you can just think of it as a hash with done with a random key, a random number or secret number. So when we create the provenance entry, we include this everything. We include the commitment, we sensitive information, non-sensitive information. However, when we so this can be called a disclosable provenance entry. And when we compute the checksum, we use the things in the blue here, the non-sensitive stuff and also the commitment of the sensitive information. So when we are going to publish this to the outside world, we can take off the sensitive information. But because we computed the checksums using the commitment, we can still provide prove the integrity. We can do a lot of other things by tweaking the way we compute the checksums. Since I'm running late, I'll just skip over this. By including more than one checksum per entry, we can allow summarization of provenance chains by taking out the non-important entries, but still be able to provide prove the integrity. So to evaluate how this performs in practice, we implemented this as an application layer library. We could have implemented it in the kernel layer or the file system layer or in the application layer, but this requires the minimal change in the system, so we did that. Our SPROV library provides the functionality of the standard io.h file, and to have secure provenance, all you need to do is to relink your applications with our library instead of the standard io.h. What SPROV does is to capture the file IO calls and then record the provenance information and then pass off the file IO calls to the file system. We did a bunch of experiments and we did them in two modes. So the first mode, we stored the config disk mode, we stored the provenance chain on the disk. And then in the RAM, we also had a RAM disk buffered modification config RD, where we buffered the provenance chain in the RAM disk and then later periodically flushed them to disk. So the first set of experiments show the evaluation with the postmark benchmark, where we evaluated the performance for small files. We created 20,000 small files of sizes of 8 kilobytes to 64 kilobytes and subjected them to 100% to 0% write loads. On the left side of the screen, you see the case of 100% writes. And the overhead in this case for the config disk mode is 27%, and with the RAM disk buffering, we get down to 12%. As we increase the number of writes, as we reduce the write load, the overhead goes down. And for typical real-life cases, which falls around 20% to maybe 1% write load, we get less than 5% overhead. Now, we next wanted to evaluate the performance for for real-life file system or realistic file systems. So we took Bolesky and Resource model where they show that file size distributions follow the log normal distribution. And we created a set of 20,000 files with a median file size of 4 kilobytes and mean file size of 8 kilobytes. And we also included some large files. And we used these five, the read-write breakdown of these five existing studies, instructional lab data, research lab data, and also some papers from last year's FAST. Now here's the evaluation of this. We show on the left side, we show the performance for the disk-based configuration. On the right side, we have the one for the RAM disk buffering. Because the instructional lab and research labs are read intensive, we get very low overheads. We get less than 5% for the disk-based, and we go less than 3% for the other mode. And for CIFS, CORP, and INCH, we still have less than 12% in both cases. And finally, ECS has a really high write load. So the overhead is higher, but still, we managed to have only 35% in this extreme case. And with RAM disk buffering, we go less than 5%. So in summary, we can say that, yes, we can achieve secure provenance. We can secure provenance and provide all this integrity and confidentiality assurances with very low overheads for most real-life workloads. And if you're interested to know more, you can go look up our data files and a lot of other information in this webpage. Thank you.
We have time for a couple of questions.
Go ahead. If you wanted to ask them, go ahead.
Yeah, sure. Sorry, I think I understand how a provenance chain is connected to the most recent version of the document. You have the hash of the document there. So if you have the document in hand, you hash it and compare. But it seems to me that I could create a provenance entry I don't see how I can check older versions without being able to reconstruct previous versions of the document.
So you go to the auditor and ask them to look at the provenance entry. So the modification log contains the diff between the two versions.
Okay.
So the auditor can start at the last entry and then go back and check the hash all the way. So the audit can happen in two ways. They can check integrity from beginning to end and then check these hashes from end to beginning.
So I thought, correct me if I'm wrong, I thought that auditors could be given the ability to check particular versions, but not the whole. Any version. Am I wrong about that?
Auditors can check the integrity of the entire chain because computing the checksums from the beginning to the end, if the final checksum matches, then the chain is fine.
Right. Okay. Gotcha. Thank you.
A quick request. When you ask a question, if you could give your name, that would kind of help.
Brent Callahan, Apple. I've got a question about your paper. You refer to a document as being, I think you kind of imply that it's a single file, but of course, many documents we work with are lots and lots of files, collections of files. Does the provenance chain apply? How do you apply the provenance chain to each individual component or the whole lot?
So right now, the scheme we present here applies to each individual component. And when you combine, suppose you're talking about an HTML file, which has an image file and maybe includes some other data files. So the container, the HTML file itself has its provenance. Its provenance is when you added different entries to the HTML file itself. Now, by combining the provenance of the constituent components, you can also compute an entire history of the composite document. We're considering that now.
Okay, thanks.
I think we have time for one more question.
Peter Matsko from Harvard University. So I was wondering if you have multiple users that are colluding with each other, and even let's say if you have all authors, various other document colluding with each other, how much guarantees can you make?
Can you repeat the question, please?
If you have multiple original authors of the document colluding with each other, and even if you have all users colluding, then can you make any guarantees?
So if people collude together, all they can do is create fake entries between them. They cannot include honest people. So depending upon how many what percentage of users in a system can collude, we can provide a guarantee that the document is okay.
Thank you.
Let's thank our guest again.